I think the organizers to give me the opportunity to give a bit longer talk than the usually APS 12 minutes on what I'm doing. So thank you for inviting me. And as the title already says, this is how I, as a physicist, theoretical physicist, I have to be more precise, would look on dynamics of swamps. But before I start with what I'm doing, I will not forget to mention the people I collaborate with, Sebastian Göller and Pavel Romanchuk, we call it diploma students. They make their master's thesis, and I help them with that. Pavel is in the audience. He's sitting right here. And he had a poster yesterday. Jon Dunkel is a former diploma student. He's now doing his PhD in Augsburg. Vadim Anishenko is a professor in a group of nonlinear dynamics in Russia. I learned a lot of what Arnold Tang and nonlinear puppet oscillators are about. Werner Ebeling was my PhD advisor. Sasha Mikhailov, I did something together. And Frank Moss, he came with a lot of nice experiments which motivated me to work on swarms. And Lutz Szymanski is a kind of teacher I have for the last 10 years. So, swarming. So as we know from a lot of species and individuals, the individuals tend to form groups, and within these groups, they move coherently. So wild beasts live in herds, as you can see right here, and there were not much nicer pictures yesterday. Fish form schools, as you see right here. You have these nice rotational motion and straightforward motions. And like everybody has, I have this picture too. I just want to prove I read the same papers. And locusts move in large swarms. We had very nice talks yesterday about that. Birds fly in flocks. I have this nice army ant picture, what Ian showed yesterday. Theodor C. Schneeler in 1948 already started experiments on these army ants and fooled them while he was laying out the food in circles. And then due to their pheromone trail, what you learned yesterday, they started to run in circles, and they run for 5 days until they died. And as a theoretical physicist, for me, that is a proof that there is a natural existence of a limit cycle. So a limit cycle is not just an idea of mathematicians dealing with nonlinear dynamics. It's just can be there in nature. And the bacteria, Eschleben, Jakob, and a lot of other groups make very nice experiments on bacteria. And you see, this is the Petri dish from top, in the top view. Herbert Levine, he's in the audience. They wrote a Nature article about that. So the top view of the Petri dish, and you place food all over, and then you place the bacteria colony in the middle, and then they, while eating up the food, they move outwards towards the edge of the Petri dish, and they do it on trails, and on these trails, they rotate in little clumps. And this is a zoom in such a clump, and this is the video recording of such a clump, and you see this clump is rotating. And there, there are other video recordings, so you have rotating clumps. And not just rotating clumps, you find even bagel. This thing is kind of, excuse me. This is not a criticism. Should anybody else use this? So they move in bagel-like structures and more complex structures, as we could see. But I'm interested in these collective motion like these. And Dictyostelium discoideum is a singular cell organism and has a very interesting life cycle. And for instance, Herbert Levine did very nice experiments on that too. And if the living conditions become bad, they have the program come together in groups. So they, via a DLA-like, diffusion-limited aggregation-like structures, they come together and form a group. And after 10 hours, they form the group, and then this group starts to rotate to form like a tip-like, they form a tip, and then all the way After 24 hours, they have formed a fruiting body, and within this fruiting body, they can survive the bad living conditions, and if the living conditions become better, they spread out again and live as singular cells in the soil and in the forests. Very clever strategy to survive. And what I like right here is, for instance, these rotational types of motion, which can be described with the approaches I show later on. Another very nice experiment was done at the Center for Neurodynamics at University of Missouri at St. Louis, supervised by Frank Moss, what is a collaborator of mine. And actually, this was the food of the former experiment he did. He did experiments on paddlefish, and Daphne actually were the food for this paddlefish, and did a stochastic resonance experiments on the paddlefish, and got very nice results. And one day he was looking for the food, so for the Daphnia, and he came into the lab, and the aquarium, in the aquarium there was a huge tornado-like rotational structure of these Daphnia, and he was amazed. And then by accident he was moving some whiteboard, what was behind that aquarium, and suddenly the tornado stopped. And he thought, ooh. Moved it back to the same position, and again the tornado tellus, this rotational moving structure, started. So he gave the paddlefish experiment away to his postdoc and said, you are on the paddlefish now, I'm doing Daphnia. So the food of an experimental setup can become an experimental setup as well. That's the proof right here. So then they did really precise experiments, so they have a very flat aquarium, and they put Daphnia in there, and they switch on the flashlight, and they have to do the room is dark because they attract the visible light, so they just want to get the attraction via the flashlight. And what you see right here, they attract it to the center of the light and rotate around this light shaft and make a very nice vortex structure. So if you see, what we've seen in these motivating pictures was like directed motion, as you have seen of the fish, and most very often we see rotational motion, and we have amoeba-like motion as well. And this was already predicted in a very nice book of Kubu and Simon Levine. There are some students of him even here, that we have these basic three types of motion. So if we look at these three types of motion, or at these, the question occurs, and the question, to me at least, what are the basic features which have to be put into a model to resemble coherent motion as they can be observed in nature and society? And the answer I would like to give throughout this talk is that we need a model which at least has a stationary state which is far from equilibrium, because we have permanent motion. So, and permanent motion cannot be described by an equilibrium system. And then we have to put some interaction into the model, what leads the individuals to form groups and to keep together. And of course, we cannot avoid to put fluctuating forces into the model. It can be external fluctuations, internal fluctuations, just due to the individual specific behaviors of every animal or every particle. So what is this talk going to be like? I will talk about the physicist approach, and everybody from, I think from high school or even earlier knows what I will be used. I use just the second Newtonian law, F force equals mass times acceleration. And I will introduce the active Brownian particle model, which actually is something like this. And I'll explain to you what is negative friction about, how this negative friction comes from energy dipoles, how we implemented it. And then I will talk about confined particles. First, I will talk about external confinement, some external potentials, and then I will talk about a lot of different types of interaction. And I will summarize. So there is actually what this theory is about. We have the force is mass times acceleration. So acceleration, this is not done for the theoretical physicists in the audience. But due to the fact that I don't want to bother you about with that, but I've heard there's not only physicists and mathematicians right here, so I just thought it's going to be convenient to put this slide on. So acceleration can be written down as the time evolution of the velocity, and the velocity is the time evolution of the space coordinates, and from now on the space will be like the variable r. So this is the model of active moment particles. So the force, every particle feels, has three parts, three components. There's the they take energy out of the environment, so there's the energy depot. They interact and they fluctuate. So, and I will use equations like this. So this is the depot force, so there's a friction force, but in contrast to the usual Stokes friction, the friction I use right here can be negative, and it depends on the velocity itself. So, and then there's the interaction force. It can be a direct interaction between the particles, or it can be just an external potential. And there are fluctuating forces. And most of the time, I use Gaussian white noise, mean zero. So, and if I take the equations of the mean of the velocity, this part will vanish out. So how do I choose these friction forces? The first type of nonlinear friction which came into the science community was done by Rayleigh in 1894 in the second volume of the Theory of Sound. And if you look for that book, take this one, there's one of 1879. He hasn't written down, he has not, there was, this equation was not in there so far. So this is actually the equation of friction where the violin string feels. So the violin string, you move it, and then it swings, and there's friction due to air friction. This is this part, and this part is the energy input to keep the tone constant. You have the bow, and with the bow you put energy into the system. So the violin string gives a constant tone. If you just,
pluck,
yeah, right, thank you. If you just pluck and wait, the tone will go away due to the friction. But we will use this equation right here in order to simulate the energy input to the system. So that's the first nonlinear type of friction. And what it does, if you look at this friction function right here, this is the friction function depending on the velocity. For very slow particles, slow velocities, we have the friction is negative, and due to the fact that it comes into the equation of motion with the minus sign, that would mean an acceleration, minus times minus is plus, you know. So but this would be an acceleration for slow particles, and for fast particles we have a damping. And in the stationary case, everything saturates at that point where the friction compensates to zero. So we have a quasi-Hamiltonian system. It's not a Hamiltonian system due to the fact that we have energy input and dissipation. But there's a compensation of energy input and dissipation, and we have the stationary velocity, which is just the square root of gamma 1, which is the energy input, divided by gamma 2. And Andrea Bartozzi yesterday talked about this model already. This is pretty academic type of friction function to use for animals. This is a more, how a physicist would say, biologically motivated friction function. What we have right here is we have usual Stokes friction, of course, and then we have the particles take up energy out of the environment with a certain rate Q0. Let me explain it right this. And so we have particles, every particle has its own energy at the depot. So we have friction right here, and we have energy input in the equation right here. So everybody has its own energy depot with a certain conversion rate, D2, it will convert the energy out of the depot. So and the depot has its own time evolution, so they take up energy out of the environment with a certain rate Q. Of course, this rate Q can depend on the space quantum, so just imagine the food depots are distributed. So if you think in terms of monkeys, there are not bananas always in every place, where certain trees with us bananas and a certain amount. Then they have internal dissipation losses, because they have to digest, and they convert the energy into energy of motion. That's the, you can make it more complicated right here, this term, but this is the first assumption. If we think of that the relaxation of the energy depot is much faster than the relaxation towards the stationary velocity, we can adiabatically eliminate this equation. So this tends to zero, and we can then this is an equation for the velocity. We could put it back into the equations of motion. So we have it turns out that we have a friction function like this, where right here is the energy input rate, this is the energy conversion rate, and this is the internal dissipation rate. And then if we look at this type of friction function, assuming that there's food all over and the energy depot will not empty so fast, so it's going to be a stationary depot, then this function looks like this. So again, for very slow particles, we have a pumping regime, an acceleration regime, and for fast particles, we have the dissipation regime. And now, who's familiar with expanding things in series, if I expand this function right, if we are close to the stationary point, I can expand this right here, and then I will land right here at this friction function. So gamma 1 is just a function of these parameters right here, and gamma 2 another type of function of these parameters. So close to the stationary point, I can either use the Rayleigh friction or this type of friction that's very similar to each other. So that's what I'm doing. Due to the fact that this is a Langevin equation, I can find to any type of Langevin equation and a corresponding Fokker-Planck equation. The Fokker-Planck equation is an evolution equation for the probability to find a particle at space coordinate x with a velocity v at a certain time step. And then this friction function ends up with a drift, as a drift term, and the probability along the velocity axis of this probability. So the friction moves the probability towards a certain velocity. Either it accelerates or dissipates. The noise ends up in a diffusion of the probability along the velocity axis, and the force leads towards a drift along the velocity axis as well. I can write down a stationary homogeneous solution for this Fokker-Planck equation. If I think of a force-free model, I just look at the types of friction right here. So I set this to zero and write down a stationary solution of the Fokker-Planck equation for the Rayleigh model. It ends up in an equation like this, in a formula like this. And what you see, and now I plot this function right here, depending on the velocity in the x direction and the y direction, and you see for negative gamma 1, what was the energy input. If the energy input is negative, you have even more friction than we had before. So the stationary velocity will be, distribution will be a Maxwellian distribution, how we call it. It looks Gaussian-like, so the mean is 0, and we have just 2 moments left. And then if we turn the energy input on, that means we go through gamma equal to 0, you see that the system undergoes a bifurcation velocity space, and you see right here the stationary velocity distribution is not Maxwellian-like anymore. It's not an equilibrium distribution anymore. The mean is still 0, but the most probable velocity is the square root of gamma 1 divided by gamma 2. So we have these head-like distributions. The same I can do for the depot model. It just looks a bit different. And the bifurcation parameter, if I fix all the others, can be the energy conversion rate. So if the energy conversion is not very effective, so almost close to zero, but still higher than zero, we end up with a max value distribution. And if the energy conversion is more effective, we end up with a head-like distribution, as we ended up with a Rayleigh model. So we already proved the first thing, that this type of negative friction gives us a permanent motion of the particles. Now, what we do, as physicists usually do, we put the whole thing into a parabolic potential. It's the only thing what we really can calculate, but we write it down pretty complicated. So we have an external confinement. So think of that. This is my particle right here down at the bottom of my pointer. And what can this thing do in a parabolic potential? It can rotate, right, as you see, and it can swing. But if I perturb swinging motions, I always end up with a rotational motion. So, and if I, with arbitrary initial conditions, I will end up with a rotational motion. What you see up here are daphnia, single daphnia with a switched on flashlight. So what we think, the flashlight is kind of a potential for these daphnia. And what we see in the, this is the three-dimensional subspace of the four-dimensional phase space. These are the space coordinates, x1, x2, or x and y. And this is one of the velocity coordinates. And you see you have two types of attractors. And one attractor belongs to the right hand, to the clockwise rotation of the particle within this parabolic potential. And the other attractor belongs to the counterclockwise rotation within this parabolic potential, within this external potential. So, and I need two initial conditions, two different initial conditions for weak fluctuations, to resemble both of the attractors. If I have a stronger noise, I just need one initial condition, and the system is able to cross the separatrices between these two attractors, so it can jump between right-hand rotation and left-hand rotation. And this experiment of Frank right here, you have seen, hopefully, that 50%, almost 50% of the single daphnia run clockwise around this light shaft, and 50% run counterclockwise. But about this swarming, about daphnia, there will be a much better talk tomorrow or on Friday by Bruno Eckert, because, I mean, we assumed right here parabolic potential, and of course the light should not be resembled by a parabolic potential. This is just the first idea about it, and they have much better potentials for this light. So the question, the next question which occurred, we make it much more step by step more complicated. How stable are these rotations if the external potential is not a parabolic, like is not as symmetric at this parabolic like potential? So we have there's a coupled oscillator. I have an oscillation in the x direction and an oscillation in the y direction. I couple these and I come up with this rotation like mode. So, but if the frequency of the oscillation in the x direction is different from the frequency of the oscillation towards the y direction, the question occurs, are these rotations still stable? Okay, we can measure that. So this is my new potential with different eigenfrequencies right here. And I have like a detuning parameter, what is the relation of the two eigenfrequencies. Omega 1 is the eigenfrequency towards the x direction, and omega 2 towards the y direction. And then we can calculate the stability region. Right here you see the detuning parameter of my potential. So I detune the potential, I deform it. And this is the energy input rate, gamma 1. And what you see is that within this gray region, rotations remain stable. So we published this a couple of years ago. And outside that region, rotations won't be stable. And to the people who are familiar with nonlinear dynamics, this is just the first Arnold tongue. Now I have some snapshots of the two-dimensional subspaces of the four-dimensional phase space. So this is the space x1, so this is the real space. You see you have rotations left-hand side and right-hand side. Of course, it's in sort of deformed potential, so the rotations are not circles, but they have ellipses. So these are the other subspaces. Then I switch on the noise within that gray region. I'm right here, somewhere right here. Very close, but inside to the borderline, but inside the stability region. And a little noise does not destroy the rotational motion. So you still have the rotational motion towards the clockwise direction and the rotational motion in the counterclockwise direction. And now I just move the system a little bit outwards that, just a little parameter change. And what you see, there's no rotation anymore. We call it this like, this is to the people who are familiar with nonlinear dynamics, now the particle fills, in this motion, fills up the whole resonance torus. So how can this be applied to swarming? That would be a question I would ask if I would be you. Think of that the interaction within a swarm onto one particles within that swarm can be approximated via a mean field of the interaction of the other. So you have one particle within that swarm, and there's a direct interaction to every other, but then actually what he feels is the mean field of all the others. If this mean field, and I can write this down right here, so this is the mean field potential, so I have a direct interaction potential between all the particles, and there's a certain density of particles around this particle x r prime. So and then I integrate over all the particles, and I come up with the mean field. And if this mean field can be approximated via a potential which looks like a parabolic-like potential, even with different eigenfrequencies, then rotations are stable of this clump. Or the other way around, if I find rotations within clumps, within swarms, then I would say that the mean field interaction potential is a parabolic-like, or is a potential which is a slightly shifted parabola, two-dimensional parabola, within that stability region. And that's what we did 3 years earlier than Andrea. We put the Moritz potential. We took 20 particles interacting via the Moritz potential. And we found out that they rotate and they change. Right here's the movie about it. And then due to interaction with the walls or due to noise, they change their rotational motion. So that means the mean field of this Moritz potential has to be a parabolic-like field. And right here we have more particles. And you see, if the mean field is not parabolic-like, then you don't have rotations. You have like amoeba-like motions or direct motions. The smaller the clusters, the more rotations are possible. So, and we have seen similar pictures yesterday by David Greenbaum. So let me come to another interaction. So now we know how stable rotations are. But swarms are not just rotating, right? So the question is, if I have a translating moving swarm, so if I have a swarm, how I would call it in the translational mode, is there any transition between translation and rotation? And what is the transition parameter? What leads a swarm from translating to rotating swarms? As Ian said yesterday, of course, a vortex has not always the same reason, but this is one idea how we can come from translation to rotations. So assume that we have our nonlinear friction right here, and then we have the easiest interaction we could think of. We have just little springs between the particles, so they just attract each other. No repulsion so far, and we keep them away from each other because of the fluctuation. So the probability that they sit on top of each other is very rare because of the fluctuations right here. So and then I prepare a swarm in a directed moving mode. So everybody at the initial condition moves towards the same towards the same aim. And then I observe this directed movement. I have a little red arrow that points towards to the right. So the swarm goes to the right. These are the time snapshots. It looks like it goes upwards, but look, this is right. These are 50 space steps right here in the x direction, and these are just 2. So it is going right. And then I turn up the noise, the fluctuations. I increase the fluctuation forces, so the every particle is like more different, has a more crazy idea to do something. Can be stress, for instance. That is, if their predator comes, I assume, I'm not a biologist, and of course they will jump on me if I do biological assumptions right here. But if a predator comes, I could think of that they have a lot more stress, and everybody wants to escape. But on the other hand side, they want to keep together. So fluctuations are increasing, and what the swarm does, the mean velocity of the swarm goes down, and at a certain strength of the fluctuations, it stops. So this is the mean. This is the absolute value of the mean velocity. So actually, this is fluctuating around zero. So that this is not really zero, it's because of the I took the absolute value right here. So and the absolute value goes down. So the question is, what does the swarm do if he doesn't move anymore? Here we go. I start with a directed moving swarm, and what you see is that first the form of the swarm is more elliptic-like or bean-like, like a little bean. So, and then due to the increasing fluctuations, the form of the swarm becomes more like a circle or more like that the mean field potential is a parabolic-like. And what you see, it starts to rotate. So I have a transition between translating moving swarms and rotating swarms just via increasing the noise intensity. And we published that last summer. What you see in the dispersions of the swarm, so this is the transversal dispersion of the swarm. So how big is the swarm to orthogonal to the direction of motion, and this is the dispersion of the swarm with increasing noise of the longitudinal mode, and you see that the longitudinal mode is increasing faster than this mode. And then at this transition, both dispersions fall together. So we have a circular shape of the swarm. And what we see, we can even calculate the exponents of this increasing of the dispersion. And the transfer dispersion increases with the exponent 1/2. And the longer dispersion increases with the exponent 1/1. I was lying. This is the longitudinal dispersion. This is the transversal right here. The longitudinal increases faster. And what you see right here, so we have in this paper down here, we made a theory how this dispersion increases, and the dotted line is this theoretical approximation, and the diamonds are the simulations. And you see there's a pretty good agreement between theory and simulation. Okay, so far, if you remember of the Daphnia, you've seen if there's a large clump of Daphnia, there...
When you said this theory and experiment, you mean?
Experiment means simulation.
Okay, and the theory, what kind of a theory is it?
What we do is we try, so we look at the deviation of the swarm at the dispersion towards the y direction and towards the x direction. And we see that we can actually, the fluctuations towards the x direction much more crucial than towards the y direction, because these fluctuations, they end up via a multiplicative noise into the equations of motion for the x direction. But I have to, it's a longer, it's like...
Yeah, it's just the flavor of the theory that I'm asking you. So what is it? I mean, on one side, when you showed us those points, they are, of course, numerical simulations of all of the equations. And the theory is based on what? I mean, in the sense...
I take the Langevin equations.
Yes.
And I average them over the particles. And I notice via this averaging process and some approximations in how these how the deviations of every particle in this direction and this direction look like, I can write down the equations of the average motion, and I will see that I will have an additional noise towards the x direction. That's why it's increasing faster than the y direction.
So the final thing, and this will be very short, is for average quantities, is that what you write down? Your theory is about average quantities without any further fluctuations?
The dispersion of the particles. This already has an averaging process behind that. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but I will show you, I can print it out.
Sure.
Just a little more about that. So,
can
you calculate the shape of this effective potential after you go through this process?
Right here?
Right, I mean through this.
This averages out in one direction and in the other direction. You just have some additional term of some velocity increment towards because of the interaction.
Okay.
It takes too long. I just wanted to show that's why I wrote down this citation right here. And if somebody is interested, especially in this transition, I would love to talk to you later on about that, really. I have like 20 minutes left, is that right?
Yeah, okay.
I'm too fast. If we remember the Daphnius form, how it was rotating, I will remind you that there was just one rotational mode. There was just a clockwise or counterclockwise rotation. So how this symmetry breaking occurs, and what we first thought is that these Daphnia, they move in water. So maybe there is an interaction mediated via the water. So there's an hydrodynamic coupling. Due to the fact that we didn't want to solve the Holmer-Stokes equation, and if we looked at this behavior of the Daphnia, we assume that there's a laminar regime when they move in this clump, at least at that experiment. It wasn't that way in the experiment Frank Moss has seen the first time. That I think there was turbulence there, but so in a very shallow aquarium, it's almost two-dimensional system, so it's a laminar regime, and so we can approximate the diffusion of the mean velocity, what we have in the Navier-Stokes equation to describe the fluid, can be approximated via a Rosine tensor. This was done in 1915 by Mr. Rosine. This looks very complicated, I believe that. So we can write this down differently. I have a velocity increment for every particle because of the interaction of with the other particles. Or just think of that you have a ball moving through. Just try it in your bathtub. Put two balls there and lay one there, and it doesn't move. And then you move one ball close to the ball which is quiet and doesn't move. And then you move the other ball. And then you see there is a drag because of this moving ball, because this moving ball was moving the fluid, and this fluid, there's a drag force onto the ball which didn't move before. So there is a force parallel to the motion of the moving ball onto the ball which didn't move before, and there is a force perpendicular to the moving ball. So if I have the ball right here and I move this one right here, then this ball will move that way. And these are the two forces, one perpendicular and one parallel. So I have a velocity increment or decrement depends if there are two balls moving that way. Of course, they decelerate each other. So in this velocity increment, I put into the equations of motion with a certain strength. And then I switch on, of course, my external potential. And what you see, I start with a clump of particles, and first they divide in two types, the clockwise and counterclockwise rotating swarms. And then one swarm, because of fluctuations, is a little bigger than the other one. And the bigger swarm eventually convinces the smaller swarm to turn the direction its direction of motion. So most of the time, people come up with the questions, but right here, they move like on a line within the parabolic potential, and the Daphne, they move in a real clump.
Right.
What I've done right here in the simulations is that every particle has the same energy conversion rate, the same dissipation rate, internal dissipation. They're identical. But as we are not identical one to another, the Daphne aren't identical either. So if I give every Daphne its own dissipation rate, its own conversion rate, then you will have a whole, everybody will run on its own track, and this looks like a clump rotate. I did this, but I haven't put a movie right in here. So that the rotational motion changed. At the beginning, we have an angular momentum, which is zero, and then I have two swarms. One is going to the right-hand side and to the left-hand side, and finally, the right-hand, the clockwise moving swarm wins, and all particles run to the left, to the right-hand side. Yesterday, Pavel had a poster about chemical interactions of these particles, and we try to describe bacterial motion with the help of this chemical interaction. So the ants spread the pheromone, the bacteria spread a chemical when they were eating. If there's a lot of food, they spread a chemical, it's called oxidative stress. At least Herbert Levine and Eshel Ben Jacob wrote that down in a very nice review article. And this oxidative stress is built up, and if there's enough food, the bacteria are attracted by this chemical, what they spread out themselves. So there is a information transfer to the other guys, look, there's a lot of food. If there's a lot of chemical, there was a lot of food, so this is attractive. And the field is going to be depleted, and it's diffusing. And this is the interaction, so the every particle runs into the maximum of the field. There's a typo. This has to be a plus. Pavel did it right on the poster. So what we have a species A turning with a rate Q into a species. It remains itself. These are the bacteria, and there comes up the species B. What is the chemical? And if I think of just overdamped motion, so gamma is not depending on V anymore, it's gamma zero, and beta, what was the sensitivity of towards the field gradient, is constant as well, then I can reduce the probability density of species A, depending on R and V, to a density just A, depending on R and T, and then I rename the density of the chemical into B, and then I have like A goes to A plus B, and I write down the Fokker-Planck equations of the system, which look like a chemotactical equation reaction diffusion system. This looks like the Keller-Siegel model, and this was my question for Andrea. This is the model, look like your K if you take this system right here of interaction. So here, there's your interaction with the kernel. and but this is the field. So this B has to be K times rho. But it was my question. Maybe you know what I mean now. So this equation leads to clustering. So we have this Ostwald ripening. Of course, we find this too. Even though we take, where's my mouse? Here. And depending on the diffusion constant of the system, so for a low field diffusion, we have a lot of clusters at a fixed after a fixed time. And for a high diffusion of the field, of the chemical field, we have just one final cluster. If I wait infinite, very, very long, this system will relax to a one cluster regime as well. That's what we call Ostwald ripening. The big eat the small ones and become even bigger. So that's, you see that this cluster is going to eaten up by this one very soon. And this is not going to live long anymore, and this one too. So they move toward. In contrast to the usual Ostwald ripening regime, to the Keller-Siegel model or chemotaxis model, what you've seen before, right here, the particles do not just diffuse within these clusters. They really do move. And how do they move? What do you think? They rotate. Of course, the external potential of such a clump can be approximated via a parabolic-like potential, and within these parabolic-like potentials, they rotate, as you see right here. So I have like four times, this is like time 12 to 14, this is 14 to 16, 16 to 18, and 18 to 20. So I just cut some of the trajectories out of the time series, and you see it's rotating right inside. You see that on this projection, this is the x, y coordinate, and this is the velocity of the x coordinate right here, and these are the projections. And you see this because of the change of the shape of the cluster, the rotation is a bit disturbed, but it relaxes back to a rotational mode, but it is left-hand side. You see that this projection looks different right here. So we have rotations within these clusters. But still, we cannot describe coherent motion of clumps. So how this can be described. The first thing I got out of the nice review of Herbert Levine was that these microorganisms, they actually sense the local concentration of the chemical biomembrane receptor binding. So they have no chemical sensor. They just, if there's more field, they have more bound receptors and they count the receptors. But due to the fact that they don't have an infinite number of receptors, this sensing of a chemical field has to saturate. So this is what is written down here. So this is what they actually count is the number of occupied receptors divided by the sum of the free receptors, but the occupied receptors is the number of all receptors. And then, so that's the way how they sense it. And then if they sense the gradient of that field, the field gradient has a saturation term right here. So then I have to rewrite my chemical sensitivity towards that field and what was called receptor law. And additional, so now I have, I switch on the system with saturation, what makes can make the things move, and additional I switch on, because they are on a liquid medium, I switch on a velocity interaction hydrodynamic like, and I do it like Tamás Vizsaik did. So they within a certain sphere they align the particles towards the same direction of motion. So I put in a hydrodynamic type of a velocity coupling with a strength 1. And what a cluster looks like, then suddenly we find these bagel-like structures. The rotations comes just generically out of there's a kind of potential which is parabolic-like, and the velocity alignment comes because of the velocity coupling, so that's why they go all towards the one direction. So there are the particles, and this is the chemical field at the same time. If I increase this interaction, I can have more complicated structures. And what you see is this rotation kind of stops, but it seems to be a very stable regime, so the swarm relaxes back to that type of rotation. So it goes like an eight. What I could imagine, if you have this like energy input times the delta, what was the detuning parameter, I have a stability region right here where they have rotations, but I have a stability region right here where they have eights, they're running in eights, and I have a stability region right here where they're running in such structures and all that. So I have a lot more stability regions to concerning take into account the theory of Arnold atoms. And there's a more even higher interaction strength of this velocity coupling, and you see we just have a moving cluster. What you see right here, we have periodic boundary conditions. And this is the chemical field what belongs to that simulation. And this picture Pavel just gave me this morning, because we've seen it in Ian's talk, we can, and he's using this Wyszek interaction as well, so we added it to the chemical field. What we find as well is, this is the interaction strength of the Wyszek model, so how strong particles are aligned at every time step. And what you see right here, this is the angle, the mean angular momentum of such a rotating swarm. And this is the mean velocity, parallel velocity of the swarm. So if this mean right here is 1, it means all particles go parallel. And if it's close to 0, they're not correlated anymore. The velocities are not correlated. So, and if you see, you increase this Wyszek interaction strength, and you have a maximum number of rotations, and then if you increase it any further, the rotations stop, and we have a directed motion of the system. Ian did this thing, I think, the other way around, but it's actually the same. It's the same thing. So we have a rotation, and it stops then. let me just the last couple minutes introduce you a more sophisticated model, which I did together with Sebastian Göller. We looked at trajectories of four-agent monkeys and the Yucatan Peninsula. There was a very nice paper with Jose Mateos and some biologists of UNAM in Mexico City. So they found that these monkeys, they make anomalous diffusion-like patterns between like banana trees within their region of the jungle they forage for food. And we thought, okay, maybe we can resemble this via a depot model, as I showed you before. They have some constant velocity, of course they do. As we have like 5 kilometers per hour, I don't know how much miles per hour that are. The monkeys go with a mean velocity as well. So we have this nonlinear friction term right here. They have fluctuations. Then we couple them, so they aligned. This is a kind of Wyszek interaction, so the alignment of the velocities, and I make this the distance of alignment has a certain distance. This alignment, this is the sphere within the alignment is taking place, and this is an attraction that they want to be together. And then they have an attraction which because there's food, and this food is distributed, and we distributed the food in a little, like we put it like we had like cone type of potentials, and they have different heights, and then they eat this food up, so they're not attracted by this tree anymore because they know no bananas anymore, and so on. And then they have a more easy energy depot, because we noticed that this Ebeling model of the energy depot is not very applicable if you really do not eliminate the energy. So this model just goes like the particles are taking energy, accelerating like they could not accelerate in nature, and then they die immediately. And so you cannot apply this to biology. So we had to change the energy depot model a bit to keep it more biological. And what I forgot to put right here, we took a multiplicative noise too as well. And these are the first movies of monkeys in the jungle. So these circles right here are should resemble the food depots. Though the bigger the circle is, the more food is in there. Actually, this is just the simulation. If the food depot becomes smaller, we plot it like a smaller circle. But actually, the circle keeps constant. Just the depth of that potential goes upwards. But Sebastian wasn't able to put that in one movie, so we should forgive him. So this is for two different interaction strengths of the group forming interaction. So they vary some steps. And what you see, if they run into a food potential, they rotate within their potential, and then they come together. And so, and right here you see the energy, the mean energy of the monkeys. It's going up if they are within the food potential. If they run, it goes down, and they have to search for another food depot. And for a different interaction strength, this is this movie. Yeah, let me just summarize this talk. What did I try to convince you of throughout the last hour? First, I hoped I could convince you that the active forming particle model is a pretty easy but powerful model to describe swarming behavior. So you have actually just to tell what is the interaction between the individual particles. You can maybe extract that from data. That's what I talked to Darwin Greenbaum yesterday. Maybe one would analyze the data to know what is an interaction between the individual particles. Then the mean velocity of a certain species, and we have some fluctuations, and you can get a lot of effects. You can resemble rotational motion, the transition between translational and rotational motion, the stability of rotational motion, and so on. So summarizing, it's a promising model, I think. The bases are just the Newtonian equations plus some fluctuated forces, so we have Langevin equations. We can implement that by a simple Euler scheme and investigate the behavior of swarms. The observed motions look very similar to the compared to the observation of natural systems. Okay, so far it's still qualitative, but what we did with the chemical interaction is already towards the quantitative description. So we have just two parameters. They are free. And we want to write down a bifurcation diagram there. So we have two basic motions extracted throughout the talk, and we have investigated them. We have a critical intensity of noise where the translation is preferred. And this can be shown analytically in the macroscopic transport theory as well. I didn't present this here. And then we have various interaction with various nice results. Thank you for your attention.